This is Car Expert.
Their particular dealership is very low on the Sahara and the GXL. If you want a 200 series Land Cruiser with the V8, it's going to have to be an absolute base model.
Mitsubishi needs to be careful that it doesn't start pricing its cars like Mazdas, because it doesn't have that cred or that clout.
It really is a jack of all trades. It's like a Japanese Swiss Army knife.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner. This week, it's a pleasure to have Paul Marrick on the show.
Mandy, how are you?
Very good. And joined by Scott Colley.
G'day, Mandy. Now, would you really say it's a pleasure to have Paul here?
Should have said your name instead, maybe.
Yeah, but she's not blind, so that's...
Paul, apparently you own a Tesla.
Yes, I haven't mentioned that before. yes, I do. Now, I just have a very quick and interesting story. So yes. The other night, a degenerate came into our apartment building garage complex. He followed someone in. And over the period of like half an hour, 45 minutes, he went through every single car to check if it was unlocked, found one car that was unlocked and took a bag out of it. And luckily, our amazing security people that are on sort of 24/7 saw him on the cameras, called the police, and the police came very quickly and arrested him. I then later on went and had a look at the Sentry footage on my Tesla, which I just leave running all the time when I'm not in the car, and it spotted him trying to open our car. And what I find absolutely remarkable with these thieves and how stupid a lot of them are, it comes up with a giant message on the screen that says, "You are being recorded," yet he stayed around trying to open the door, looking inside the car. And I'm like, dude, there's four cameras that are recording you at the moment. So I just love this new technology in cars, and finally getting a chance to see it in action was really cool. And the cherry on the cake was him getting arrested and probably with our weak judicial system getting a slap on the wrist, and we'll be back at our garage before long.
Just remember, we're not on 3AW right now.
Yes, welcome to left-leaning Scott News.
Scully, you sort of dropped a bit of a interesting point just before we pressed record. Your grandma has bought a Tesla.
She has. So this is my mum's mum. She's 80 years old, and she was asking me about a whole lot of cars that she recently wanted to be looking at to buy. She had a Mazda 3 sedan on her list. There was a Subaru Impreza, a Skoda Scala, a Hyundai i30 sedan. And about a week before we went out to test drive all these cars, I was reviewing a Tesla Model 3 long range. And she said, "Oh, I'd be very curious to come for a drive in an electric car." And so I took her for a spin. She lives in South Yarra, so around Albert Park, and, you know, very normal urban driving with her in the passenger seat. And she was so taken with it that every single car she drove after that, she said, "Look, I like it, but I think I like the Tesla more." And so, yeah, she went, and there's a Tesla, call it showroom, dealership, whatever you want to call it, in Chadstone, in Melbourne. She went down there and she's got herself a white standard range with a black interior and the wood grain trim. It's an ex-demo car that she got a pretty decent discount on. They traded in her car and everything else. She loves it. She absolutely adores it. She drove it to a recent family function and all the kids were having a play around with it. And she sort of was pretending to be very high tech and show off with the app. But she was still blown away that I could then like honk the horn from a distance and check the charge and turn the aircon on from the app. She hadn't worked that out yet, nor had she worked out how to set the radio presets. So she's got the hands, not the hands-free, but the assisted driving stuff worked out. She's got the nav worked out completely fine. She's got charging sorted. My plan is that eventually I'll change the indicator so it farts when she turns it on and see how long it takes for her to change it back.
Scott, would it be fair to say that you're still striving to be as cool as your 80-year-old grandmother?
She is a really cool woman, even aside from the Tesla. And she said that she read some horrible guff on Car Expert about some guy who bought a Tesla, and that almost turned her off it. But she pushed through.
She follows me on Instagram, so it's all good.
She does have Instagram, actually.
Oh, my God. But she sounds like a really hip lady.
She is. The thing I found really interesting about her Tesla purchase, though, is Tesla is all about this unique new buying experience. You don't go to a showroom or a dealership. They're not trying to sell you a car. You order it online and it just shows up and then you go collect it. Except now all of a sudden with this Chadstone setup, you can buy a car through a dealer. And she gave me a call on the last day of April, of March, saying, I've organized the car. My trade-in's all sorted. I'm happy with the price. the guy is desperate for me to go and pick it up today. I couldn't work out why. I'm going, what difference does it make to him? Today's Wednesday, tomorrow's Thursday, who cares? Mm. And I looked at the date and I realized that this guy's probably desperate to get the car across the line before the end of the month for some target he's been set internally. So for everything modern and fresh about Tesla and the way it does things, some things never change.
This makes me so, so happy. A lady in her 80s is happy about buying a new car, and something that none of us would think about buying at that age. It's incredible.
Yeah, she's a big advocate for the brand, and she absolutely loves it. So it's cool to see someone buy a car they're passionate about. So, Mike, to start car news this week, Victorian electric vehicle policy is in the news, and it's not positive.
No, it is not. Just to catch you up, from July 1 this year, there is a proposal in Victoria to introduce a mileage charge or tax on electric vehicles or plug-in hybrids. So 2.5 cents per kilometre for EVs and 2 cents for PHEVs. Now, the rationale for this is obviously a significant driver of road funding is a fuel impost, and if you are, or a fuel levy, and if you're not using petrol or diesel, you're not contributing to that. So the argument is EV drivers should be contributing in some way, shape or form. Nowhere in the world has really done this though. And of course, advocates for green and environmentally friendly cars are sort of shouting from the rooftops here and saying, hey, hang on, we've got 0.6% market share. Introducing this tax on us now is going to kill demand and sort of make it much harder for people to transition to green vehicles. So it's met with a lot of controversy. And this week, a list of 25 different organizations, including car makers, charging infrastructure providers, rideshare firms, and environmental groups, all signed up to an open letter that they ran in The Age and said that the Andrews government's proposed tax on electric vehicles is the only standalone electric vehicle tax in the world. No other jurisdiction has introduced such a targeted levy on the cleanest vehicles on the road without significant incentives to balance it off. And it actually called it the worst EV policy in the world. And just to give you an idea of who's involved in this open letter and who has said that, the likes of Hyundai, Volkswagen, Uber, Tritium, which is the world's largest maker of DC fast chargers, the World Wildlife Fund, and the Australia Institute think tank. So this is a very wide, diverse group of organisations who've all come out screaming about this. Doctors for the Environment Australia, Get Up, Solar Citizens, the Clean Energy Council, SEA Electric, Jet Charge, the Australian Conservation Foundation. I mean, these are sort of well-known organisations who've come out railing against this. So basically, I just did a story during the week getting the thoughts of numerous stakeholders and getting the thoughts of the government. And the state government has stood by this proposal, and it said that it's working with the crossbench now to do whatever tweaks it has to do, but it fundamentally stands behind it. I think the general sense in the industry is that clearly we need to move away from a fuel levy as we move to the future of all cars being electrified. We're going to have to come up with a new way to fund roads. So maybe a mileage tax makes sense, but just exclusively putting it on EVs is as silly as putting a tax on luxury cars, which we already do. We don't need to, in my opinion, make this situation even more complex by adding bespoke taxes that are so difficult to actually enforce. I mean, this is requiring EV and FEV drivers to actually keep detailed logbooks and send them to VicRoads, and then VicRoads will send you a bill. I mean, that's a system that can quite easily be scammed, I would have thought. Basically, our piece during the week just laid out the pros and the cons, both sides of the argument, and I think the general consensus here is the government might have made a little bit of a misstep.
The interesting thing here for me is that this is not subtle. It's not a backdoor conversation. It's not one of these particular groups using the media to try and get a message to government, because these are all the ways that these negotiations usually go. Clearly, all of that's failed for these companies, and they're now just going the nuclear option and trying to turn public sentiment against the government, which is kind of unusual in the automotive industry. We've seen sometimes on certain policies, car makers will come out and take a bit of a swing, but it's rare to see such a large group band together and just wind up and go bang, for want of a better term. So clearly whatever's been happening previously hasn't worked.
Yeah, and the other side of it is the federal ALP, and of course the Victorian state government is an ALP government. The federal ALP has just put out a significant program to try and encourage the take-up of electric vehicles. It's put that to the electorate and said, if we get elected, this is what we're going to do. The ACT government, which is a mixture of Greens and the ALP, have got very strong subsidies and interest-free loans and other things like that to encourage EV take-up. So it seems like the Victorian state government is out of step with its own party, not to mention out of step with what the industry thinks, and what obviously people who are interested in environmental protections think. It just seems like this is a policy that was designed fundamentally, and you know, clearly there has to be a way to help fund roads. It's not as if fuel levy is the only source of funding for roads, but it's a source of funding, and you have to address that. But this seems like a pretty clumsy claptrap policy on the run that hasn't been particularly well thought through, and it may get up, but it's going to be pretty hard to enforce properly, I would have thought.
We've seen a number of counter proposals from motoring groups that are far cheaper. We've also seen people come out and say it should be abolished entirely. My understanding is this isn't meant to come into force until the start of July, so there could be a lot of water to go under the bridge in the next few months before this actually happens.
Yeah, lots of the old political argy-bargy. But onto the complete opposite side of the spectrum, Scully, from EVs to very much not an EV, we've got some exciting Toyota Land Cruiser news.
We do. So the Toyota Land Cruiser 300 series is the biggest story in motoring at the moment, because Toyota is much better than most car makers at hiding what's actually happening. And it's also much better at just not saying anything. Every time you ask Toyota about the Land Cruiser, they smile and say, what Land Cruiser? We don't know about that.
It's like the nuclear codes.
It is, exactly. I sort of imagine when this car is finally released, the photos will be on a USB in a metal briefcase that's helicoptered to head office. But finally last night, the first undisguised pictures of this car leaked. They popped up on some Facebook groups and we very quickly covered them, showing that it's going to get what is probably an evolutionary look. It's got slimmer headlights and a more bold, sort of broad grille at the front, but realistically, it still looks like a Land Cruiser. On the back of that this morning, we've learnt from a source that sort of understands what's going on with the Cruiser that the new car is likely to launch globally in August, which is a little later than initially intended, but it appears even Toyota's not immune to this semiconductor shortage going on. And it's not likely to be into Australia until the first quarter, potentially late in the first quarter of 2022. Toyota Australia hasn't confirmed any of this. They've played the game they like to play and just played with a straight bat and said, we know nothing. So at the moment, we're working on information from someone who knows what's going on around there. But it does appear the new Land Cruiser will be on Australian shores early in 2022. In the meantime, stock of the 200 series is starting to run out. We spoke to one Toyota person today who said their particular dealership is very, very low on stock of the Sahara and the GXL. If you want a 200 series Land Cruiser with the V8, it's going to have to be an absolute base model with velour seats and a little radio. And we're seeing that the cars that are left at the top end of the range, prices are just through the roof. You covered a couple of weeks ago, Mike, that people are paying up to $185,000 for a V8 Sahara, which to me is madness. But it appears this could go on for quite a bit longer.
Yeah, well, we've got the situation now, of course, post-COVID, where people can't travel overseas, and so they're all buying their dream big 4x4 to tow their big caravan around. Lots of these people, they're getting a bit older. They've probably sold their Sydney or Melbourne house for 10 times what they paid for it 30 years ago, and they've pocketed a chunk of change, and they've splurged. You know, that's to generalise grossly, but that's a significant market, and we are seeing Land Cruiser sales going through the roof. One, you know, theory around that is that it's almost certain to be the last V8 Land Cruiser. People are quite stressed about the almost certain death of the V8. We're pretty sure that this new Cruiser is going to have a 6-cylinder diesel engine, as well as a hybrid at some point down the line. People also forget that Land Cruiser wasn't a V8 until relatively recently either. It was always a 6. So we're kind of going back to where we began. But, you know, Toyota has said all along that, you know, whatever technology it puts in this car, it needs to be as capable or if not more capable than the car that came before it. So I suspect that one of the other reasons why the car's been so long in gestation is Toyota's really trying to make sure that it gets everything right. But there's no doubt that you've only got to look at the analytics of our side or any other to realise just how keen on Land Cruisers Australians are. So we're going to hear a lot more about this very soon.
It's going to be really interesting. What we understand based on reports from overseas is that it'll launch with a 3.3-litre turbo diesel 6 with more power and torque than the current V8 engine. There's also expected to be a petrol offered overseas. It's unlikely to be in Australia based on just what we know about the current Land Cruiser lineup. And then a petrol hybrid could come in either 2022, but later in the year, or in 2023. So a pretty big departure from the current Land Cruiser. But based on all the conversations you've had with, I know, with Sean Hanley, who's the head of marketing for Toyota Australia, And based on the fact we know this car is so significant for Toyota's unbreakable reputation, the Land Cruiser and the Hilux are the two cars that people think of when they think of Toyota being that reliable brand that you want to take a, you know, a caravan on the back of around Australia. I'd be staggered if these new sixes aren't a step forward from the V8.
Well, what I would say is, you know, we're not going to go into this saying that Toyota has nailed the 300 and that it's a better car than the 200. But what I would say is Toyota has earned the benefit of the doubt until proven otherwise. So when we drive it, if it turns out to be a pile of crap, that's a step backwards, we'll say it. But I think Toyota's earned the right for us to at least give them the benefit of the doubt before launch because, yeah, they've proven themselves time and time again for generations. So let's hope that this builds on what has been a massively successful vehicle for them.
Now, from the best-selling car maker in Australia to one of the best-selling smartphone makers in the world, Huawei, Mike, is building a car.
Huawei is indeed building a car, better known for smartphones. Of course, the Chinese smartphone maker has run into some grief with its 5G rollout. It's fallen foul of some geopolitical snags, it would be safe to say. But yeah, the Shanghai Motor Show during the week, it revealed a car called the SF5, and it is a plug-in hybrid SUV. It was developed in partnership with the Chinese-owned, California-based startup Ceres. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. And it'll be sold through Huawei flagship stores in China. So in other words, you go into a Huawei store, which is a lot like an Apple store, and you can walk out with a range extender hybrid SUV. The car can apparently run in pure electric mode for 180Ks, but that is on the fairly relaxed Chinese emissions claim. So what that would be, WLTP, is a little unclear. And it's got a 1.5-litre petrol engine generator. 405 kilowatts of power and 820 newton metres of torque is the claim, which gives you a 4.7-second 0 to 100 time. It's got a lightweight aluminium chassis with double wishbone front suspension and multi-link rear suspension. Obviously, it's going to have a super seamless infotainment system. Given Huawei is a smartphone maker, you would bloody well expect the interior tech would be up to snuff. All the active safety features, and I have to say this thing looks pretty good. So Huawei has partnered with the BAIC Group as well to put a car into production. So it's sort of been down this road before. Apple, of course, is working on a car. It's one of the worst-kept secrets in the industry. Sony unveiled a prototype of its Vision S sedan at the start of last year, although it's not going to actually make it. So we're seeing a lot of tech companies trying to dip into the world of automation, especially, you know, plug-in hybrids and EVs. And I suspect a lot of that's because it's up in the air now which brands are going to dominate the EV space going forward. So I reckon some of these smartphone makers reckon there might be an opportunity for them. Whether this ever comes to Australia, look, it would seem unlikely at this juncture, but it's definitely interesting that a smartphone maker is making a car.
It's not the first time we've seen this. Sony, a couple of years ago, released its Vision S concept car, which is a very similar idea. And it sort of shows, like, we've now seen Google move into properly the infotainment space with Volvo to start with, but with a fair few companies now. It's actually building the base for their infotainment system, not just Android Auto on top. More and more people expect their smartphones to be integrated with their cars, and more they expect just to be able to move from car to house to office and not have to think too much about the transition. So kind of stands to reason that a smartphone maker will be the one that can nail that best, given their experience with software.
And deep pockets to help fund automotive startups, you know, they can provide the capital and, you know, the other mob they work with can provide the know-how. I suppose the other one that's interesting to me is how they're going to sell this. So you buy a phone on a plan, right? A subscription plan is how most people have a thing. They'll lock it in for 2 years and they'll pay it off monthly. Now, we already know that Volvo and a few other brands are moving down this path. I would imagine that the Huawei car will be quite similar. It'll introduce a new way of owning a vehicle. Every year you have the option of upgrading into a new one maybe. You know, you pay a fixed fee, you pay less and less as time goes on. There's all these options opening up. So I think as well as the vehicle, it's also the sales strategy that's going to be really interesting going forward.
And if you are going to do that, it makes a lot of sense to do it with an electric vehicle where in 2 years' time, if you're Huawei, you can rip the batteries out of the cars that are being traded back in and put them in home storage. You can sell the car again, you know, obviously like most car makers do at the moment. But there's all sorts of options on the environmental side of things that could also be beneficial if you are turning your car over every 2 years.
And the final one, Scully, is you've been over in Adelaide speaking to some brass from Mitsubishi Australia. They've had some pretty interesting things to say over the past few days.
They have. So Mitsubishi opened its new headquarters in Adelaide on Monday of the week we're recording. It'll be a week before the podcast actually goes live. And it's this really big high-tech space with electric vehicle charging, with some really clever renewables set up right next to the airport in Adelaide. And we went along not only to see the new building, but to sit down with Sean Westcott, who took over as Mitsubishi Australia CEO on April 1 in 2020, which for those of you who can remember last year, even though it feels like it was 10 years ago at this stage, was about a week after the first round of national lockdowns were announced, to chat about what Mitsubishi is doing at the moment and where it wants to be as a brand. Often with these chats, car makers and CEOs keep their cards really close to their chest because you don't want to be on the record saying something bold and then not achieving that target. But that's not quite the approach Sean Westcott took. Instead, he said he wants Mitsubishi to be the third best-selling brand in Australia at least, which would mean overtaking either Hyundai or Mazda. It's unlikely they're going to overtake Toyota on top of the sales charts, which is a bold goal for Mitsubishi, which finished last year in fifth behind Ford as well. It plans to do it in a couple of different ways. It plans to do it with Triton, which at the moment is getting a little long in the tooth compared to some other cars, but down the bottom end of the range in particular, value has always been a strong suit. So don't be surprised if you see a real focus on lower-end Triton variants in marketing aimed at small businesses. That's one opportunity that Mitsubishi sees. The other one, which is quite unique, is that Mitsubishi sees as an opportunity for volume in its plug-in hybrid cars. So at the moment, it's got the Outlander FEV, which is quite unique in the midsize SUV space, though there are some more coming later this year. But as of the third quarter of this year, it will have the smaller Eclipse Cross plug-in hybrid. And then in the first quarter of 2022, it's going to get the brand new Outlander, which looks fantastic. Bones underneath are shared with the Nissan X-Trail in plug-in hybrid as well. And we don't know what's going to power it just yet, but we're expecting at least 70 kilometers, potentially up to 100 kilometers of range from the battery. And Mitsubishi is essentially saying now is the time for this technology to really be put in the forefront of people's minds, to really be marketed more aggressively, because the Outlander FEV has always been one of those cars that if you know, you know. It's almost like a Skoda in the Mitsubishi range. And if you're aware of it and you know what it's good at, then it's fantastic. People who own them love them. But a lot of people have no idea what a FEV is, what an Outlander FEV is, and why they should be looking at them.
It's all going to come down to price, isn't it? Because we've seen the regular hybrids that Toyota makes, just 54,000 sold last year in Australia alone by Toyota. That's one quarter of its grand total sales. The RAV4 hybrid's so popular now that there's still a six-month waiting list, even though that vehicle is into its third year on sale. So people are all into mild hybrid tech. Plug-in hybrid tech is obviously a bit more complicated. You've got to charge it to get the most out of it. But, you know, a lot of Australians also have range anxiety too. So this does seem like an ideal bridging tech for a lot of people who do want to start to make the switch over to an electrified technology. Educating the public on how to use it's one thing. Getting the price right is quite another. But Mitsubishi was the first in this space. I remember back in 2012, I drove the Outlander FEV and I had no idea what the hell it was. No one did. Like, honestly, it was we were all so naive at that stage. This was a whole new thing. And it's come a long way. It led the charge back then, and it's sort of appropriate that it wants to lead the next wave. So I wish it luck. It's got its work cut out for it. It's interesting that on a slightly tangential note, I spoke to, you mentioned Sean Hanley before, the marketing head of Toyota Australia, and he's ruled out bringing in the RAV4 plug-in hybrid for now because he reckons it would be too expensive and there wouldn't be enough interest in it, which is quite interesting when you consider the normal hybrid, as I said, is so popular. So two massive car brands thinking very differently about the appropriateness of FEVs for the Australian market. It's going to be super interesting to see how it plays out.
It is interesting you mentioned price as well, because when we think of Mitsubishi at the moment, we think of it as a really solid, reliable, but kind of value-focused brand. It's a fairly common refrain in reviews about Mitsubishi and conversations we have with people is you see the list price, but go in and talk to a dealer and it's unlikely you'll actually pay that. That could be changing going forward. It seems like the new Outlander is going to be a more expensive car than the one it replaces. We spoke also to the head of product at Mitsubishi, and he essentially said it'll be focused on value, but don't expect it to be down the bottom end of the price spectrum. And we also know it's got some new product coming down the track. Eventually, we think it'll be 2023. There's going to be a new Triton. It's going to be the base of the next Nissan Navara as well, with a fair bit of Australian engineering input. The Eclipse Cross FEV also is a more upmarket car inside. It's got some more upmarket tech than the regular Eclipse Cross. So it feels a little bit like Mitsubishi is maybe laying the foundation to not completely move away from its value-focused origins, because obviously that's still its spot in the market. But just to slightly inch towards focusing more on its new products and the quality of those products, because obviously as better stuff and bigger stuff and newer stuff comes from overseas, you're not going to be able to maintain bargain basement prices. So I think that's one we need to watch with interest.
They do need to be careful though, because the fastest growing brand back in 2019 was Kia, which is obviously a very value-focused brand. And the fastest growing manufacturer at the moment is MG out of China, which is also a super value-focused brand. With more and more car companies getting more expensive, these entry-level companies, not Kia's probably not quite fitting into that category, but MG certainly is, they're scooping up a lot of buyers right now. And Mitsubishi needs to be careful that it doesn't start pricing its cars like Mazdas, because it doesn't have that cred or that clout. And working in the Car Expert Experience Center, we're really seeing that too. The general feedback we get from punters is solid, reliable, do the job, not the flashiest thing in the world. Now, yes, the new product is going to be a lot better, but even so, reputations and reality don't always align. So I certainly hope Mitsubishi isn't getting too far ahead of itself just yet.
Certainly one to watch with interest. That's a wrap for Car News this week. For all of the stories we've talked about today and everything else that's broken since, head to carexpert.com.au. Now, Mike, this week you have been driving something very interesting, but it's not a supercar or a new super SUV. It's a little bit cleaner than that.
Yeah, so I sort of hinted at this last week when I gave a very, very brief explanation of the Toyota Mirai hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicle. But my review is now live, and I thought it'd be worth coming on to just have a bit of a chat about this technology, because a lot of people are quite curious about what a hydrogen fuel cell EV is. They'll hear a lot of people like Elon Musk and Herbert Diess, the head of Volkswagen, who are basically saying that fuel cell is a stupid idea and will never work. But then you've got Toyota and Hyundai spending billions and billions and billions of dollars to R&D hydrogen fuel cell technology. So, you know, what is the reality here, and what is the technology, and what is it like to actually drive one? And I've actually driven two in recent times, because there are now two on sale in Australia, the Hyundai Nexo SUV, which is doing fleet trials up in Canberra, and the Toyota Mirai, which is a sedan, which is now on fleet sales in Victoria. So basically, just to walk you back, the way it works is you can make hydrogen in numerous ways. It's the most abundant element in the universe, quite commonly made as a byproduct of fossil fuel production. So that's bad, and that's called dirty hydrogen. Green hydrogen is what we want, which is generally made through a process called electrolysis. Wind or solar or whatever other renewable power you want sends current through water and creates hydrogen, which is then isolated, pressurized, and stored, and then pumped into a vehicle. Now, a car like the Mirai, you can fill it up in 5 minutes, and it can do about 600 to 650 kilometers on a tank. It's about 6 kilograms all up of hydrogen on board. What happens is that hydrogen goes to a stack of membranes, which is kind of the heart of the vehicle, meets oxygen just from the air around us, and that chemical reaction creates charge to drive the motor, which in the case of the Mirai is on the back axle because it's a rear-wheel drive car. Now, the best thing about it is the only output, the only emission is pure water, so H2O, and purified air, which has gone through the fuel cell membrane. So just like a battery electric car, it uses or puts out no CO2, but unlike a battery electric car, it doesn't need to be charged overnight or on a DC fast charger in 40 minutes to an hour, and it has a super long range, and there's no real payload reduction because you don't have hundreds of kilograms of heavy batteries in the floor.
Recently, I was lucky enough to have a close look around the first generation Mirai, and although it has the clever fuel cell stack under the floor, there's all sorts of weird little compromises with it. It's got a really tiny boot. It looks quite awkward on the outside, and it also was a little bit range limited to the point where we filmed it for the day, and we were a bit worried about heading out to somewhere to film and then heading back, because obviously infrastructure is limited. So what's changed with the new one to fix those problems?
Well, the main problem is infrastructure, and that isn't really fixed yet. So Toyota has built its own hydrogen refiller powered by solar at its Altona headquarters. And because it has a 600 to 650K driving range, you don't need a refiller on every street corner. But for the moment, that really is suited best towards the fleet partners that will be the first 20 customers for this vehicle. Longer term, infrastructure is the issue. And the reason why battery electric cars are so far ahead, well, first of all, there are losses when you convert something from a gas and put it into a wire and then back again can. And every step of making and putting the hydrogen into a car, there are losses inherent to that, right? So first of all, there's that. But secondly, infrastructure. Everybody has a PowerPoint in the house. Everybody can easily have a wall box installed. There are fast chargers proliferating everywhere. Hydrogen fuel cell depots ain't that common, and they're really bloody expensive to set up. So that is going to be the fundamental issue. It tends to be agreed that in the future you'll have them at bus depots, garbage truck depots, the docks where ships come and go. So heavy industry will be able to use it because you know how much distance those vehicles are covering. You know what their refill times are going to be. So that makes a lot of sense. But certainly infrastructure needs to be addressed. The likes of the CSIRO are building a new facility. The government has just poured billions into making lots and lots of green hydrogen for export to Asia because Asia's got a really high demand for it. So there's no doubt. And you look at the Hydrogen Council of Australia, all of the, Shell and BP are all on board too. So you can easily see a future where hydrogen pumps are common. But as it stands right now, there ain't any. So if you have a Mirai and you can't make it to Altona, which is Toyota's headquarters, you are kind of buggered, which is why for now it is a fleet trial. Now, in terms of the car, it's chalk and cheese. So the old one, as you said, was pretty flawed. This new one does still have a very small boot. This is a Camry-sized vehicle, but the boot is half the size of the Camrys because you do have three really big tanks, one longitudinally down the chassis, two running the other way across the rear axle. So they basically bookend the rear axle. That impacts back seat space. So the fifth seat is pretty much useless because there's a huge drivetrain hump and the boot's really tiny as well. So in terms of packaging, it's still a long way behind a BEV. But the way it drives, just brilliant. It sits on Toyota's new architecture, so it actually rides and handles beautifully. The new system is so much quieter than the old Mirai. It drives like any other electric vehicle. One of the things that you really got to get your head around is that at the end of the day, a hydrogen car is an electric car. What is doing the driving is an electric motor. The only difference is rather than the motor getting power from a battery, it's just getting power generated on board by a fuel cell. So it's still quiet. It still gives you instant torque. 9 seconds to 100 kilometers an hour isn't exactly rapid, but it certainly is fast as a Camry hybrid. So in terms of performance, it's a huge step up. The interior is quite beautiful. It's really nicely laid out, well-equipped, well-specified, well-made, the best infotainment system of any Toyota out there. And the way this car looks, clearly Toyota has designed it to be, I guess, a halo, like a rolling proof of concept. And to really get the most out of it, it's had to make it look super sexy. And it does. I mean, if Toyota made a nice version of this or a hybrid version of this, it would sell its socks off. It looks amazing. The downside, of course, to all this is price. Now, you remember when the first plasma screen TV came out and it cost 20 grand. When the first Prius came out, it cost twice what a current one does. It's no different for hydrogen. So you can only get it on a lease for 3 years, $1,750 a month, which equates to 63 grand over 3 years, plus the best part of 3 grand for servicing over that period. Now, that does include free hydrogen from Toyota's refiller, but that ain't cheap. So it's going to be hard to find fleet partners initially. What's really interesting about all this, though, is Toyota is really bullish about the future of this technology. The company reckons within 5 to 10 years, we're going to see hydrogen cars in its dealers. And I think it's really looking towards cars like Hilux and Land Cruiser, where you need extra payload, you need quick turnover times, you can't have downtime where you're charging. The company again affirmed this week its commitment to fuel cell moving forward alongside battery electric vehicles. So, look, right now it's up in the air. There are some brands that have ruled it out, but Toyota's going gung-ho on it, so is Hyundai, and neither of those two brands tend to do things lightly. So while the common wisdom is that fuel cells is the future for trains and buses and trucks and heavy industry, there's still a chance in my mind you'll see it in smaller vehicles as well. And I don't think anyone really knows the way the future is going to manifest. I don't think it's like VHS and Betamax. There's possibly scope for both. But it's definitely awesome technology that's really cool to kind of see at the beginning.
I think the last question that's worth asking, and it's one that we see whenever there's a new technology, is how safe is a hydrogen car? Because if you talk about compressed hydrogen, I think massive explosion.
Hindenburg.
Exactly.
Everybody knows that famous image of the Hindenburg. Look, of course, hydrogen is a flammable element, but this is pretty old proven technology now. I had a good chance to have a look at one of the hydrogen tanks that are on board, and these things are coated in about 4 inches of carbon fiber reinforced materials. I mean, there is no way that you, I mean, for instance, I remember I went to Hyundai's headquarters in Korea once, and they actually talked about the fact that they actually had military come and shoot these tanks full of rounds, and they still couldn't pierce them. So the line tends to be the tanks are so strong that there's no way that any crash will cause the hydrogen to leak out and explode. And then on top of that, there's built-in redundancy. So rather than just the hydrogen has a, there's a way that the tank collapses in the worst case scenario to emit a really narrow targeted stream of it. So it would be like a very thin explosion, but it wouldn't be a catastrophic one. So there's no doubt brands have thought this through. The Hyundai has aced all of its crash tests. The Mirai hasn't actually been crash tested independently yet, so I can't say it's particularly safe, that particular car. But as a whole, fuel cell technology safety is very much proven now. And it's not as if a tank of petrol or diesel isn't combustible either. So, you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I think just like battery cars, there are a lot of questions about the tech, but safety is not something I'd be concerned about, no.
Perfect. Well, that story is live on carexpert.com.au. Let us know if you've got any feedback in the comments below. Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Looking to explore Australia but need a decent rig to do it? Well, many would go for a Toyota Land Cruiser, but there are other choices out there, like the Nissan Patrol. Paul, you've got a chance to drive the MY21. Why do you think the Patrol is often overlooked for the likes of the Land Cruiser?
I heard you say decent rig, so I thought you were referring to me.
Welcome back.
Yeah. No, look, it's really price and capability. So when you look at the luxury level here, so we tested the Nissan Patrol TIL, which is the top spec. It's priced at around $90,000. The top spec equivalent of the 200 series is at that $120,000, $130,000 mark. So there's a massive gap there in price, but you really don't notice it in terms of value, terms of what you're actually getting and off-road ability. So one is obviously a petrol naturally aspirated V8, which is the Patrol, and the Land Cruiser is a turbo diesel V8. But the Patrol's quicker. It's about as efficient within sort of Kui, and it's just as capable off-road as well, and it will tow just as much as the Land Cruiser as well.
It's worth mentioning that there are Land Cruiser Saharas right now listed for $180,000, $185,000 on the classifieds, because that model is going away. And our understanding is you can't actually necessarily buy a Sahara or a GXL from a lot of dealers now. So the Patrol also has the benefit of just still being on sale.
Yeah. I mean, it's when you think about it, they haven't updated this a great deal. It has received a new front and rear design. It received a new interior in the States and also the UAE. Unfortunately, we didn't get any of that, so the interior is incredibly dated. But I think that when the new Land Cruiser comes out, they'll be forced to update the interior. And I think once that's there, it is really the complete vehicle. I don't know what else you would need to change to really justify the big price jump to the Land Cruiser.
You just mentioned that the interior is a little out of date, but how practical is it?
Look, it's just as practical as the Land Cruiser. So they both have that chilled fridge in the center. They both have a third row of seats. Funnily enough, the entry level of the Patrol actually has 8 seats. This top spec version has 7. The only downside is the third row is a little cramped for adults, and that's because the second row can't slide forwards or backwards. So you are a little compromised there. But outside of that, it has literally everything that you need. It is missing smartphone mirroring, but for the most part, it's fairly well equipped.
Give us some specs, Paul. What's under the bonnet?
This is the thing I like about it the most. So I mentioned earlier that it's a naturally aspirated petrol V8, which makes all the right noises when you step on the throttle. And it is a 5.6-litre unit. It produces 298 kilowatts of power and 560 newton metres of torque. It'll tow 3.5 tonnes braked, and it also consumes around 14.5 litres per 100 k's on the combined cycle. I love the fact that when you stand on it, it sounds tough. Like it has a real note.
It's funny. I was in the city a few days ago, and I heard this sound. I'm like, whoa, what is that? Is that like a, I don't know, some muscle car? It was a Patrol.
Well, you know, you can actually get a supercharger kit for them and also an exhaust. It's probably insane.
Does that kit also include the second, third, and fourth mortgage on your house to pay for the fuel?
You know what? It sounds like it uses a lot, but in practice, when we've tested Land Cruiser before, it sits around the 12 litre per 100k mark. Given that diesel is more expensive and you have an absolute canyon between these in terms of purchase price. I don't think the fuel economy is actually that big of a deal. You well and truly up regardless of how long you own the car. You've got to be doing some serious Ks to pay it back. So, yeah, it's remarkable how little you care about that fuel economy when you look at the actual purchase price of them.
No doubt a lot of people would probably use a patrol for towing or just going off-road, but how does it handle like a day-to-day life?
Look, it's interesting. The steering is best described as vague. It's pretty sort of big. So if you're driving in and around the city, it is a whopper of a thing. But you get this sort of 360-degree camera. It's amazing quality, but it does come with front and rear parking sensors. It's got adaptive cruise control. Off-road, it has a number of settings. So it's a full-time four-wheel drive, but it also has a sort of a lockable four-high mode, has a four-wheel drive low-range mode, and also a rear differential lock. And an LSD. So it is pretty well equipped on that front. You have a number of off-road driving modes as well that tailor the stability control. Ground clearance of around 270 millimeters. So it is well and truly high enough to clear pretty much everything you throw at it. It really is a jack of all trades. It's like a Japanese Swiss Army knife.
What do you think of its styling?
Look, I like the front. The back I kind of like as well. It's just the interior where it looks like it belongs in the 90s. It's got the old wood grain. It's sort of, it is just a little bit funny. Do you guys like it?
I'm a big fan of the way it looks on the outside. It's always had a bit of presence, but with this most recent update, they've really kind of cranked it up, and I love the detail in the tail lights. Although it is a shame that the interior still looks how it does. Paulie, you mentioned off-roading, and that's obviously where the Land Cruiser really has its reputation. This car is designed to do dunes in the Middle East and all sorts of stuff in the US. Will it go across the Aussie outback like maybe we'd expect some of its rivals to?
I don't see why not. I mean, you know, it's I say this sort of a little tongue-in-cheek, but it is a basic engine. It's naturally aspirated. It's a V8. Takes petrol. It is fairly basic in terms of the way that it works. And it's been out for such a long time now that there are parts all over the place for this. So it's not like you're going to be in the middle of nowhere and never be able to get parts. Yes, you do have better coverage on Toyota dealerships across Australia. But at the end of the day, this is, again, stuff that you take into account with the purchase price. You're willing to take that slight risk of, being in the middle of nowhere and being further from a Nissan dealer. But I'm confident that there's enough of these getting around now that parts and fixes are going to be easy enough to come across.
Mm. Do you know the servicing costs for it in intervals?
Yes, expensive. What I found really bizarre, both this and the Land Cruiser, both require servicing every 6 months, which just seems absolutely crazy. So over a five-year period, petrol comes in at around $5,700 or an average of $570 a service. The Land Cruiser costs $1,200 less at around $4,400 over a five-year period. But keep in mind, immediately after that five-year period, the Land Cruiser gets quite expensive to service. So it bridges the gap fairly quickly. But yeah, the running costs of this, in addition to the fuel, is servicing, and it really just is not cheap. That is expensive.
So, Paulie, off the top of your head, the Patrol is about $90,000 in top spec trim from memory, which is kind of knocking on the door of X5 or Q7 money. If you're not off-roading, would you recommend the Patrol as kind of an alternative to those cars, or do you think it really is about towing, off-roading, hitting the open road?
I don't know. I think they're all nice cars to drive. They all have modern tech, but you just cannot beat a Patrol for space inside. It has quite a presence. And towing, I'd be far more confident towing in a Patrol than I would an X5 or a Q7. I think this really is quite sure-footed. And if you're closer to that 3.5-ton limit, this is going to be far more confidence-inspiring behind the wheel.
You've given it a car expert rating of 7.8. You can check out the video and the written review up at carexpert.com.au. Well, that was a bit of a mixed bag this week. That puts an end to this week's podcast. Some cars that we've got coming up next week in the garage. Scully, please fill us in.
It is a very varied garage next week, as is often the case. I'm driving at the moment a Peugeot 2008 Allure. And that is going to be swapped into something very similar, a Skoda Kamiq 110 TSI Monte Carlo. We've also got the MG HS 2-litre turbo all-wheel drive, which will be very interesting. It's a new engine, I believe, for that car. a Mazda CX-8 Touring and a BMW X2 base model. We've also got Tony Crawford, I believe, up in Sydney going to check out the new Skoda Octavia RS. We've got one in Melbourne at the moment as well. So there's plenty of different cars coming through.
And obviously every single thing on the website is worth reading, but anything in particular we should call out next week?
Well, yeah, everything on the website is worth reading. You're absolutely right. next week we have got going live the Skoda Octavia RS review. That'll be on Friday. So Paul is working on a video as we speak. I'm doing the written review. Not allowed to tell you what the car's like yet, but looking forward to sharing that because the Octavia RS has got a really cool little reputation in motoring circles as the thinking man's Golf GTI. We've also got a review of the Nissan Leaf E+, which is the longer range Leaf. It looks identical to the current car. It's identical inside, but it's got a much bigger battery. So James Wong was driving that this week, and the review will be live on Thursday.
Plenty of good stuff coming up on the website, carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, Paul Marrick and Scott Colley.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.